We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling. Hi, everybody.
I'm Nick Kane.
I'm Lauren Bailey.
and thanks for listening. What a start.
Woo! Podcast 12. Hi, everybody. We've already said hi, everybody. So I've just said it twice. But we need to say it twice because we're a little late this month.
We are. So it's like 2 months in one for everyone right
yeah.
now.
We'll double.
But Lauren, guess what?
What?
It's exciting times because it's our 1 year birthday for
yes.
the podcast.
Woohoo! For those of you who don't know, we turned one in February when we originally recorded.
We did.
But we had a few troubles with our audio files over the last month. And we want to do a big shout out to Den Belmont and Andrew McKinnon, who both gave us their time this month to help us.
Saved our lives. So thank you very much to both Andrea and Den. And can I just remind you at this point as well with audio that we are a free podcast service. So sometimes our audio can be one of the harder things to get right, but we promise you that what we've pulled together today in content especially is super exciting.
It's very exciting. Yay. But before we get to the excitingness that is Richard Baker,
yes.
why don't you tell me about the exciting times that you've been having, Nicholas Keane?
I have been having exciting times, and I did want to start my little section, Lauren, with a quote.
Nice.
I am only one, but I am one. I cannot do everything, but I can do something. And I will not let what I cannot do interfere with what I can do. And that's from Edward Everett Hale. And
who
to be
is,
honest.
That's beautiful. Yeah, who is Edward?
He's an author, historian, and also a Unitarian priest, I believe. Sidetrack. I really wanted to get to the heart of what that meant because it's been a busy month. I've actually moved states. So while we're sitting in the same
room today, in the same room at the moment, which is a bit of a feat.
It is a feat because I'm up in Sydney now. Beautiful. I've got a tan. You can't see that. But,
do you?
Well,
I can't see that either.
Tell the listeners I've got a tan at
okay,
least.
Okay. So Nick's got a tan.
Thank you. But I'd like to talk about this idea of being fun employed. You actually said this only moments ago, Lauren, and I really loved it. This idea of being fun employed because the past month for me has been that. It's been a period of time where at the start, if we had spoken last time just after the podcast, I was feeling like I was doing a lot of work. And there wasn't necessarily...
And not seeing the results.
Not seeing the results or the reward.
Reaping the rewards.
Exactly. But after that, and I think I sat with you, Lauren, in a cafe and we spoke about the hard work that we've been doing. And I did say to you, it's closer than you think, didn't I?
Yeah.
Stick with it, it's closer than you think. And I think this relates to both of our months. So much to talk about. First of all, I've been on 3 or 4 different shoots over this past month, which is super exciting. One of the biggest ones is a role on Neighbours, which is a character arc for a character named Alistair Hall, which is a beautiful little role and quite a confronting role for Neighbours too,
really?
I would say,
yeah.
in regards to a bloke who's dealing with his sexuality. So it's a beautiful role to be able to do. I've also been on the set of a comedy series on one of the major channels, which is amazing because the producers and the performers in this particular series, and I can't say it, obviously, because there's a bit of a social media ban on it at the moment.
As there is on so much work that we do these days.
Yeah, yeah. There is. And it's super hard to do when you're super excited about working with these people, right? There's that. I shot some TVCs for Sportsbet, which have gone gangbusters as well.
Which, if you haven't seen, you should definitely look up. If anyone out there has ever wanted to see Nicholas Keane in a Wonder Woman outfit, now is your chance.
Haven't we all? So there's been some really, really beautiful things going on in my life, and it's meant that I've had to fly back and forth between Sydney and Melbourne. And that is just, I guess, the acting side of my storytelling as well, because in that time since we've chatted last, I've also been in New Zealand doing some work.
For work, yeah.
I've the freelance lifestyle is
because, of course, the last time we really talked to each other. I mean, we talked to Grant in January.
Yep.
But the last time we spoke was before Christmas.
That's right.
Yeah, a lot has been happening.
Lots have happened, and the beauty was when I did go freelance, which I did talk about in the previous podcast. I started meeting with people and started talking about where my speciality sits. And so I've met with people like Sam Tatum, who's at Ogilvy Change.
A brand guy, right?
He's a brand guy, but he's got a degree in psychology, so how the brain works. He's also got a degree in marketing and a very creative fellow as well. So it's kind of like all those little bits that I have in my life. So it was really lovely to sit down and just use him as a sounding board and a very smart sounding board, mind you.
You had to lift your game, did you?
I did have to lift my Good, Lauren, good. But it was amazing to meet him, and it's been great for my freelance work because literally I haven't stopped getting emails about work, which is...
Oh, that's so wonderful. So it's really been a bit of a skyrocket start to the year.
It's been a huge skyrocket start to the year. But I think the other thing too about that is making sure, and we talk about this on the podcast regularly, knowing when to say no.
Yes.
And knowing when to say yes. Having that balance of, okay,
and it's difficult when you're in a time of transition and you're trying to open yourself up to figure out what the new directions that you're heading in will be, to be open but still have the knowledge about yourself to say no. Like that's quite a difficult balance.
Yeah, feeling comfortable in the unknown is what it is about, really.
Uncertainty. Oh, we'll talk about that in the podcast.
Ooh. That's good. I like that theme. So it's been a busy month, Lauren, and you know, this is all whilst moving states. So look, it's a great start to the year, and I think you got to take it while it comes and really enjoy the journey when you're here. So hopefully there's a few more months of similar podcasts where I talk about all the stuff I've been up to.
Yay, fantastic.
So Lauren, can I ask you about your month? What have you been up to?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, it is this thing of our month is obviously a double month, and it's really interesting talking to you now and remembering what we recorded in February and where I was at in February. I had a great start to the year, but it was all very much training based.
Yes.
So I did some Meisner with the fantastic Erica Chestnut at the Impulse Company Australia.
Yes, beautiful Erica.
She's so lovely.
Great classes too.
Yeah. We'll definitely put a link up to those because I'm about to go into block two with her, but she'll be starting up another block one shortly and they're awesome.
Yeah.
We did a retreat with the fantastic Gabriella Rose Carter.
Yes. On one of our short films we used as the basis.
Yes, we worked on the backstory of some characters for one of the short film projects we're working on.
Yep.
And I can't remember how much we spoke about these before Christmas. I think we just mentioned that they were happening. But so Nick and I are working on two short film projects at the moment and they are on the verge of pre-production, I suppose.
Certainly on the verge. And it's been a great process too, hasn't it, Lauren? Undertaking what seemed like a bit of a insurmountable task early days is now...
Yeah, it is really exciting. But what I'm really looking forward to is the acting that's involved in these projects. Yeah. So it's been great to learn a bit more about pre-production and production, that side of things. And I've written one of the scripts and all of that, but I can't wait to get my teeth stuck into them.
That's on a social media ban too at the moment, isn't it? The script that you've written?
Yes. You mentioned this day that we sat down at lunch and we both talked about all the hard work we were doing and not really being able to see the definite outcome of that. And of course, I've also been working on a couple of shoots recently too. I've had a small role on a feature. Woo. I shot a commercial last week. Oh, and I've got a part coming up on House Husbands.
Oh, fantastic. So, my cousin's going to be so excited about that.
Really?
She loves that show. I'm just going to say, I know someone that's on House Husbands.
Yeah, well, it's a great show and I've heard a lot of good things about how much people enjoy working on it. I know we were talking earlier about how much fun you've had on set recently.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
And it's shooting soon.
Yeah, in the next few weeks. So that's sort of what I've been up to. I guess this thing that I was just saying to you about being open, I'm focusing on trusting that things are there to happen and that if I keep doing my work and I stay positive and open to things that will continue to unfold.
And I think you're right about that idea of just being comfortable in the uncertainty as well. And especially considering you've been full-time acting now for quite a few months now. How long are we?
Yeah, so it's since June last year.
Since June last year. Yeah. And how are you feeling with that process?
Well, it is interesting because I really have that identity now, and it's more a question of what is the next creative project that I'll be working on, mm-hmm. then will there be one? Yeah, so great. That's a really awesome frame of mind to be in. It's also getting used to not having a stable routine is the routine, yeah. and learning to become comfortable with that. And some days that works really well and other days that doesn't. So it's just a bit of up and down.
There's actually another level of preparation that's needed as well, isn't there? So you've got to up your preparation game, I feel, to make sure that you sit back and you look at your week and things aren't double booked, or, you know, you can get from one place to the next easily enough, you know? So there's a lot of things like that that are a part of the process of making sure that your week is...
Yeah, I definitely full. Have more of a sense now of that idea of keeping all the balls in the air.
Yes.
But yeah, at the moment, I think they're all in the air.
Life
is good.
For listeners that obviously you can't see that, she was juggling. Invisible balls, but still.
Which is probably a good time to get talking about our storytelling guest for this month.
Yes, we're both very excited about our guest. He's an investigative journalist. It's something that we've talked about over the past literally 12 months, this idea that, you know, people often think about journalism as, well, that it's not necessarily a part of storytelling.
But it's the very fundamentals of storytelling.
And yeah. I think this next interview with Richard Baker, who is...
He's just a lovely bloke.
A lovely bloke. He's an investigative journalist at The Age. You'll hear some great anecdotes about how he uses truth and storytelling
in his work. So we're here today with the much lauded Australian investigative journalist, Richard Baker. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
And we are here at The Age Building, which is aptly named Media House in the CBD. Richard, isn't it? It's a beautiful little spot.
It's a great spot. It's on the edge of the old city and the edge of the new Docklands.
Well, that's so, it. And why did you pick the venue? Can I ask a little bit more about that?
Because I work here. No. Because, look, I guess spend a lot of time in this building and back and forth from this building because it's the place that publishes my work,
yeah.
whether it be in print or increasingly, you know, in the digital space.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's the place, I guess, where people associate me with this place and I associate myself here because I've been with The Age for so long.
We did pass a lovely poster of you on the way in.
Yes, your face is literally as we walked in and then we came through. You gave us a tour just through the newsroom there, which was quite exciting as well, that sort of area where the financial review
where
is and things
happening.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yes, and a few years ago there were many more journalists there, unfortunately. Yeah, right. The tide of... newspaper companies are facing, you know, really difficult financial times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we were doing this 4 or 5 years ago, it probably would have been double the amount of journalists here.
Yeah.
But that's the sign of the times.
That's the way
and
it is,
we're
yeah.
still here. And we're
yeah.
surviving. So, yeah, and as for that poster, that wasn't my idea.
So to get started, we'll get you to read your story and we'll go from there.
Okay. So this is my brief story. I'm a 37-year-old bloke, sometimes going on 17. And by that, I still love my sport, being competitive and active. My head tells me I'm 17, my body tells me I'm 37. I grew up in Ocean Grove on the coast past Geelong and then on a farm from when I was 12, about 12 minutes inland from Torquay. I still love it down that way, get down there every summer and as much as I can and have a lot of friends and family down there. I got stuck on being a journalist when I was about 15. And we lived in London for a few months. There's so many great papers from page 3 of The Sun to The Guardian. I was lucky enough to score a cadetship at The Age straight out of uni and I haven't looked back. The joy of my job is variety, people opening up to you, and when it demands, landing a story that changes society for the better. I'm still hungry for those stories 16 years after I started, and I never tire of people giving me the privilege of access to their lives. The only thing that's changed since I started is I have two wonderful kids, a beautiful wife, a golden retriever, and an annoying cat.
A golden retriever, really?
Yes.
You do? Okay.
That makes
yeah.
me want to
life.
Defend your cat. I'm a cat person. What?
No, yeah. She keeps me awake every night, comes in and wants to be fed by me multiple times during the night, and only me, and I'm not a cat person, so... Jumps up on the bed head above me, eats, like if I have a mobile phone charging, eats the charger, just does all that sort of stuff.
We're learning a lot about you right now.
Yeah.
You know, we don't even need to ask these questions. Right. We'll just
yeah.
talk about the cat.
That was a great interview. Thanks for coming
okay.
in this morning. So let's start at the beginning. Growing up in Ocean Grove and Torquay, that Sounds pretty idyllic. What was that like?
Oh, it was a great place to grow up as a kid. Outdoors, space, the beach. Mum coming to get us from school, in primary school, on hot days when it was 35 or more. The school had a rule you could just be taken out by a parent and go down the beach. So it was great fun growing up down that way. And it's good still having family down there to be able to take my
having
kids
that to get
down.
Away to.
And yeah, and to get to escape.
Do you reckon that had a little bit to do with your personality, Rich? So you're a pretty mellow guy, like nothing really phases you too much. Do you reckon it was that beach lifestyle that did that to you?
Yeah, I think so. Probably just that contributes and just relying, I guess, on yourself a bit and for entertainment yourself, and you make your own fun because you had the space and the wherewithal to do that sort of stuff. And it was, I guess, you know, 30 years ago or so when I was growing up down there that, I don't know, the world was a little bit different place and kids seemed to be able to roam free just a touch more.
Yeah.
And so what about your parents? Were any of them creative? Did they sort of push you into creative pursuits?
Not in that sense, no. My mum's very practical, grew up on a farm, very hands-on and determined and all of that sort of stuff and self-sufficient. And my dad is, I think he had a bit of creativity in him, but sort of circumstances in his life. His father passed away when he was young and he had to go and work and leave school and get a job to support the rest of his family. But in his latter years, he's shown his creativity by going back to uni and becoming a social worker and things like that.
Yeah, right.
And then with my stepfather, who I've lived with since I was 12, he was a university professor. So I suppose there's a bit of, you know, creativity, research and writing, a lot of daydreaming.
Yeah, right.
Certainly, pondering. You can see the beginnings of, you know, how that could be a bit of a melting pot for some of your interests.
Mm. Oh, definitely. It's a good, you need probably a dash of each sort of, you know, quality, if you like, from what I've just described.
Yeah.
If you're going to be able to make it in journalism.
And you got stuck, you said you got stuck on being a journalist when you were 15 in London. You've mentioned the great papers and I can only imagine that being over in a big city like London, you were suddenly exposed to the whole world and a lot of issues that previously in little old Australia, down in Torquay, you might not have been aware of. Do you think that factored in?
Oh, definitely. It was, you know, a great opportunity to spend some time over there when I was year 10 going into year 11 at school, and just I found myself, you know, on the weekends or during the day, we have a few papers there and ranging from the, you know, the quality broadsheets back to the sort of trashier tabloids. And I just thought, wow, I've just spent 40 minutes reading about stories, people, politicians, whatever I'd never heard of until I was there. And in many cases, it was the quality, you know, of the writing or just the way the stories were presented. I thought, well, if this can suck me in and get me to spend 40 minutes without even knowing it, I'd like to do this, you know, for a job. It'd be fun. So, yeah, and it definitely got me thinking about the future.
And so you basically followed that passion that you found and studied at Deakin in Geelong. What was that like?
Oh, it was good. It was good. It was interesting sort of choosing not to go far from home and move away. It was sort of funny because you know part of you wants to get away and try out new things, and the other part it's very easy just to stay and comfortable. But I enjoyed it, and look, it was a pretty short course in terms of demands.
Was it really?
Oh, 1 year I had I think 9 contact hours a week.
Oh right, okay.
So it was pretty short, but you did learn some pretty good skills from the course, and I enjoyed the I did literary studies as well and enjoyed that component of it. So it was good, and I think. You've got to just throw yourself into those things, and it's not so much the study that gets you somewhere, it's what you add into it by putting your hands up for work experience, trying to get published or broadcast in certain places, and just, you know, picking up the phone and asking people to talk to you.
And did you get published and broadcast while you were still at uni?
Yeah, I did. I was lucky enough to contribute some stuff to the Geelong Advertiser down there, you know.
Oh, nice.
When I came across a story or something like that, and no, nothing earth-shattering or anything like that, but I think, and in other places, a university newspaper and things like that, just by showing prospective employers that you're keen to get in print and you'll do anything, whether it's been review a movie or do a Q&A with a band or submit a news story. It shows a desire just to get involved, not waiting for things to happen.
Yeah, and I guess that's what prompted you to get the cadetship at The Age, which was a move to Melbourne for you.
Yeah. So I sat, I always would have aspired to join The Age then, but sort of didn't want to put all my eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
So I also sat the test for the Herald Sun, the ABC, and I was prepared to go country.
Okay.
Need be to get a start as well.
And so was The Age top of your list at that time?
Yeah.
It was great.
And I was lucky, I got an offer from the Herald Sun too, and I would have taken that.
Yeah.
And because I wanted to be at The Age, I accepted that one. But, and I'm glad I did in a way, because it's been good for me. But I would have no hesitation in taking a job either at the ABC or the Herald Sun.
Yeah, just hungry to get out there and do something.
Yep.
So just to get all our listeners on the same page, I've done a little crash course on investigative journalism in the past couple of weeks, and I found a definition that I thought I might run past you. So investigative journalism. In the service of the public interest, investigative journalism's purpose is to uncover corruption, injustice, maladministration and lies. As a duty to readers and viewers as well as self-protection in a hostile legal environment, investigative journalism seeks above all to tell the documented truth in depth and without fear or favour. It is to provide a voice for those without one and to hold the powerful to account. It's to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Are we on the right track?
It's a good definition. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it covers the broad
principles. You do sound like a bit of a superhero.
Definitely not. There's no capes.
You sure?
I'm certain of that. There's no capes or underwear on the outside.
Yeah.
Or utility belts.
No.
Not yet,
anyway.
I can picture a utility belt with some pencils on the outside of it.
Journalism show bag.
That would
be pretty cool.
That would be great. But it's not quite as sexy as maybe that definition?
Not in everyday practice. I mean, it's just, it's a job like another job, but it is it's a privileged job because, as I sort of said in what attracts me to it and about myself, is that for some reason people respond to you or allow you into your lodge and knock on doors or pick up phones. And ordinary people who are quite generally shy or whatever will take you into their life. If we can do that, then we expose what's happening in their life. That's what investigative journalism's about, because by telling their story and exposing what's going on there and holding the powerful to account when they're failing or covering up or being hypocritical will bring about change.
In my research that I did, I found a reference to a 10-point definition used to distinguish genuine investigative journalism from just your general daily news reporting, where a story was considered to be investigative if 6 of the 10 points were present in the story. Now, point 7 asks if the story identifies victims and villains, as in the powerless given a voice against the powerful. Again, I'm going with my superhero Robin Hood type themes. But given your work on stories like sex abuse in the Victorian Catholic Church and your first major story joining forces with investigative journalist Nick McKenzie, which was a series on allegations of botched surgeries and warding against Melbourne Dr. Thomas Cosman, is this idea of comforting the afflicted from the previous definition and representing the underdog important to you when you choose the stories that you tell?
It always helps. It helps people empathise if you've got real characters.
Yeah.
But you've got to, in some cases, resist that temptation to portray black and white good people.
Yeah.
It's a simple thing to fall into, and it's easy to grasp. And sometimes there are straight-out stories like that of people have behaved good and evil. But in a lot of other cases, it's our job to find those grey areas. And, in the case of the surgeon you mentioned there, look, I've got no doubt he did some things wrong and arguably not in the best interests of the patients, i.e. excessive surgery and that.
Yeah.
But also, yeah. You know, he genuinely would have saved a lot of lives and helped a lot of people. And so in doing that, we had to really conscious that this is a person with an international reputation and a family and things. And so that line of sticking up for the people who've had unnecessary surgery or surgery where he perhaps didn't have the qualifications to do, and the motivation appeared to be a financial gain. Clearly there's a story there, but again, is this person totally evil or anything? No, they're not at all.
Yeah.
And they do have some, done some good things and had some good qualities. So it's a really delicate thing.
Well, that's the hardest thing, I think, isn't it? Trying to keep impartiality to what you're doing as you find out more about a person too. So when you're investigating, do you find that hard to do the further you get, entrenched, and it becomes almost personal for you in a lot of ways because it becomes your life for a period of time? Impartiality is hard, I guess.
Yeah, there was this sort of terminology, sort of like source captured. You can be captured almost by the story or the source and get too close to lose perspective and the bigger picture. So because you've spent so much time and you've got to know a particular source or something that's fundamental to the story, you are blind to their own flaws or perhaps their own culpability in some respects, and you really need, if you're going to be telling the true story, another set of eyes or an independent person to come in and just make sure that you're not missing those points or glossing over those things.
And how do you extricate yourself if you get a sense that you're becoming too closely?
Sometimes you don't know it's happening, so sometimes you need someone to tell you that. So that's why it's good to work, like Nick and I work, in a sort of partnership arrangement. So if one person's got particularly close to a subject or a source, the other one will deliberately stay a step removed to be that filter. And so when the copy comes in, you go, well, no, that's it doesn't seem right, and review all the evidence and documentation that you've got, and compare it to the draft of the story, what's been written, and really just run a really rigorous risk analysis, if you like, of that, and see what stacks up and what doesn't. So that takes trust between people to do that, colleagues, to let your work go to someone's independent eyes. And then obviously it goes through lawyers and editors and things. But having that step back is really important so you avoid being impartial.
And having a partner to be able to do that is fantastic, that sounding board. It's funny, on the website, on the Sydney Morning Herald Sun website, there is a little note at the side of the website that says, you can tip off Richard by emailing him at Fairfax Media. Which made us laugh a little, didn't it?
It made me want to look something random up and tip you off.
Well, that's right, because you must get some random tip-offs on stories that you just go, really? Are you really tipping me off on this?
Well, I had a guy ring yesterday.
so this is fresh.
Yeah, this is fresh, hot off the press. sounded like an older guy. So obviously he didn't email. He rang the office phone and got through and started off without even introducing himself or saying anything. He just went into this monologue. In 1957, the local council put up rates at blah, blah, blah percent. And then he went on about writing letters to the Attorney General, the Treasurer, the Prime Minister, which haven't been returned. Then he got back onto rates and then got onto the issue of immigration and asylum seekers. And got 8 minutes into, I hadn't got a word in, to the thing.
You just needed to get it out, right?
So, well, he needed to vent and I needed to go. And I asked someone to ring my mobile phone, and I put that quite close to the handset so he could hear my phone going, good, listen, I've got to take this call, I've got to go, write me a letter. And
sometimes
you just,
It must be so hard though, because really, for people who feel like they don't have a voice, that's what you represent to a lot of people.
You're the megaphone.
A possible avenue.
True, but they've got to sort of have an idea of... After 8 minutes, I had no idea what this guy was talking about.
But that's scrutiny of sources is something that I did want to cover, because it's one of those things, you must get a lot of tip-offs, as we sort of hear there. But the thing is, the good stuff, I imagine, there's no way that you can necessarily research. It's all hearsay until you follow it down the rabbit hole. And you must waste a lot of time just even trying to see if a story's true sometimes. So what's the process in regards to going through and scrutinising the sources?
Well, you know, a source or whatever is a great starting point for a story.
Yep.
It's not the be-all and end-all. Obviously, okay. If you don't have the tip-off or you don't have that inside information, say from inside a government department or a hospital or a company, that actually gets you looking nowhere. So that human contact and that source is the most important thing, because without them there's no story.
Mm.
But even when they come to you, unless they come with a suitcase full of documents, which is very rare, that's where your job and your skills as an investigative journalist come in. So one, you've got to build a rapport with them and trust. Two, then how do I verify what they're telling me? How do I prove it? They're not going to go on the record and say it. They're not going to stand up in court and say it.
Yeah.
So what do I need to do? So then you reach out to other people in your network of things, so people who might know about it. For example, say if it's something about a listed company and it's about insider trading among its executives and that ASIC's doing an investigation, well, you might know someone at ASIC.
ASIC
might
yeah.
be able to confirm off the record, yeah, we are having a look, or we have received a complaint about that.
Mm.
So there's step one. Then you go back to the company or the people involved and go, are you aware? Has there been a complaint? You know, why were these shares? You go and get their share registry and look at when shares, if they're big enough, if there's been a material change in the shareholding. So you do all your steps.
The like detective that. Work, right?
Yeah.
It's a really interesting view on how to prepare for, totally off track,
yeah,
but how to prepare for a character.
Oh, definitely.
Like the rigour that you obviously use, clearly it's, well, I guess depending on who you ask, much more serious the work that you're doing than preparing for a character. But if you apply that methodology.
Yeah, so you're using more than Google is what we're saying here.
Yeah,
you're really getting involved.
Yeah. I mean, it's
really getting inside the brain of,
building blocks.
Of the story you're telling.
Yeah. And years of experience, I imagine, have told you a good logistical way to go about it. Or is it? Do you find that every story is different?
Everything is. There are some fundamental things that you need for proof. So obviously, something on a written thing, documents on paper, documents are on paper. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Proof, written proof, transactional proof. If there is a transaction there. All that stuff is just gold.
So is that what they mean when I've heard you described as an old school newspaperman and forensic digger? Is that what they're basically describing there?
Yeah, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's just about, I really like stories that I can see, in looking at other people's work and stuff. I love to see a story that is just, is layered, and in terms of each fact or each accusation is supported by evidence.
Yeah.
I hate stories that make sweeping grand statements or claims but don't provide the reader with any of the evidence
to
buttress that, or it's really thin. And my view is, if you're writing about, high-profile people or companies or whatever that are going to fight back, you need to have really solid every point checked off and have the proof of, here's this, this and this as to why I say that.
Yeah.
It must be really frustrating for you in our current world where, journalists and editors often will defend their story as being investigative and in the public interest.
Hmm.
But when you look at it really closely, it's neither of those things. It's just interesting to the public or gossip. Like, that must...
So you're talking like Kim Kardashian gets a new haircut?
Yes.
Is that kind
exactly.
of stuff? That,
Well, look, there's a market for that, I suppose, isn't there? But it is... It's a shame that eyeballs, the desire to get eyeballs or click results in what we know is clickbait, and a lot of it, there isn't a lot of merit to it. Sometimes it's interesting or entertaining, I get that. If people on their lunch break, they don't want to be hammered over the head with a hard-hitting thing every day, and they might just want to read about diet stuff or, why such and such is good for you or where to go for a holiday. That's all got its place, but media companies that have their reputation vested in good journalism need to still find a way to promote that journalism and to provide an avenue for readers to find it.
And that's interesting. In an interview with online media site Upstart, you said a lot of people's idea of news now is just updating the internet. I don't see a great future for investigative journalism if news is just about going to an internet site that is updated every half hour. You need to work at different ways of giving a story presence. So that's interesting, because when we're talking about the articles you write, people obviously need to sit down and have time to read that article. So when you're doing that, how do you give this story presence? What's your general
Well,
formula.
I mean, things have changed even since when I said that. Okay, so that's it was an interview probably a couple of years ago. But what we're finding now, and from all the number crunches at Fairfax, and I'm sure it's the same for other big media companies, is our audience is coming through mobile phones, smartphones.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. More than compute, you know, desktop or laptop going to the home page.
Because The Age did resist that for quite some time, didn't they? They were trying to stay on the large format for... Am I correct in saying that?
We obviously, in print, we stayed in the broadsheet for as long as that was sustainable, and now it's gone to a tabloid, and that's a lot cheaper and easier to print.
Yep.
And supposedly it's easier for the reader to read. What we're finding is our audience is largely coming through now on, firstly, the smartphones and looking at the news that way, and then the homepage. But what we're finding also is through social media, particularly Facebook referrals. So, you know, someone finds an article that's in The Age, they like, they put it out to their community.
And it gets shared.
And it just gets shot around like that. And people who have been referred things by their friends will often spend a lot of time reading something right through.
Coming from a trusted source, right?
Coming from, a friend who they trust. And it might be something that they... we'll talk about next time they meet. So they feel like they've got to put the time in there.
Yeah.
So when I said finding different ways to sell or to promote that story, I guess there's an example of three or four different mechanisms through which we can reach readers, which all require slightly different presentation.
And talking about other ways to reach your audience, I don't know if you're across this, but there's a bit of a wave at the moment around the world known as Serial, not the breakfast cereal, which is a spin-off of the radio program This American Life. It's a podcast, yay for podcasts, that investigates the 1999 murder of an 18-year-old student at Woodlawn High School in Baltimore, Maryland. It's an investigative, non-fiction, documentary-style podcast, definitely a new form of multimedia there. What are your thoughts on this type of storytelling and what we can learn from it?
It's a great podcast.
I mean, I've read about it. I haven't listened to it yet. I am endeavouring to when I have a couple of weeks off in winter.
In your downtime.
Somewhere warm. And try and get into it there. But I've obviously, you know, read a lot of media about it and I think it's a great idea and it's a terrific way for people to immerse themselves and use their own imagination in a story, in that longer
because it's
form.
Quite old school, that it's really radio old school. Style. It's
Charles Dickens, you know, who wrote serials for the masses, like, you know, genuine serials for the audiences in London, where they'd buy it week after week after week. And I've seen a thing a few years ago, actually, from the Washington Post did a series, an investigation, and they wrote it like a cliffhanger, if you like. It was a 10-part series which they released more and more every day, and it was about some murders, I think, that had happened in Washington that had been reopened or something like that, and the police investigation. And it was terrific. It had all these bells and whistles, and it was purely an online-only thing, and they would tell their reader, tomorrow at such and such, we're going to post the next instalment and the next instalment. And I think we should be definitely looking at doing that sort of stuff here to keep and build an audience. But obviously that needs quality writing, editing, production for people to...
resources, really.
Resources, it does. And it's really difficult because we've lost so many journalists over the last 10 years that, you know, people are having to do more with less and are constantly updating mobile, you know, all the different platforms. So your time to research and write that sort of stuff, you know, if you're going to do that, you have a team of reporters and editors probably spending a good 3 months on that solid if you were going to do a 10 or 12 day bells and whistles thing.
Yeah. And I mean, that serial was recorded over a year, you know, and much more.
Was it really?
Yeah. Over a year plus much more research into, like, they were literally, they had a team of about, don't quote me on this, but about 12 that were constantly working on this project. And it was the definition of, okay, well, how do we tell this in an interesting way? So as you said, every week was almost like a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
So it would lead you into the next week going, okay, well, what is the next part of the puzzle that they'll share?
That's really interesting. How do we tell this story in an interesting way? I wanted to ask you about the whole idea of narrative journalism versus investigative journalism. If we look at a narrative being a story that's constructed through a particular point of view or arrangement of events. And, you know, something like Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, which is a historic example of narrative journalism. And that, I think that was the second non-fiction novel published back in 1965. And that apparently opened up the idea of journalism using creative writing techniques while holding to sort of more traditional guidelines of journalism. What are your thoughts of the importance of bringing narrative into a story?
I think in this day and age it's more important than it's ever been because, you know, going back 40, 50 years ago, the way people received their news was very driven by daily deadlines. So what I mean by that is a lot of the times people didn't know. That's why newspapers reported this happened yesterday. Well, that's no longer, you know, it doesn't go like that anymore. This happened 30 seconds ago.
Yeah.
Or whatever. There's more and more voices out there demanding to be heard. How do you get an audience and how do you get people to understand your journalism and to embrace it? And that's by having characters and a plot and all of that sort of stuff. And again, it's the most challenging part of the job is probably, you know, not everyone's a great writer. It's very hard to do and it takes a lot of work and blood, sweat and tears to get something of reasonable standard out, let alone, you know, Capote style stuff.
Yeah, I've just compared you to Truman.
Take that.
Robin Hood and Truman Capote. Better than this.
So, I did want to talk about breaking a story because I think it's really interesting. And you've just recently broken multiple stories on the front of The Age. I want to know about that process. You've researched, it's been a long process in regards to making sure you've got all your facts correct. You write the story and you know that you know it's going to be controversial the next day. So what is it like that night before when you're sitting at home, you know the article is going to be published 6 a.m. the next morning and it'll be in people's hands? How do you feel? Is it the calm before the storm? You know, 6 a.m., does that phone start ringing and you go, all right, I'm ready for this? Like, how do you feel?
Sometimes, well, you go, it's a mixture of sort of excitement and fear.
Yeah.
There's the excitement that, you know, a big lot of work is going to come to fruition and hopefully make some big waves and get people talking, you know, and get some results and maybe bring in more information, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get that initial break. The story, you haven't really cracked it. It's what comes
still
in
building.
After that. Yeah, it's the aftershock, if you like, that the best stuff comes in. But also there's this tremendous apprehension and fear of, you know, I never sleep well, and with those kind of things is have I misunderstood?
Yeah.
Have I stuffed something up? Have I spelled a name wrong? Or just anything that's going to detract. And, you know, it can be the smallest thing. A colleague of mine at Sydney Morning Herald, great reporter, Kate McClymont, done a lot of the stuff on the Obeid family
and those
kind of things up there and a lot of things with the New South Wales Corruption Commission. You know, and Kate's as brave as they come and brilliant. And she and another colleague, Linton Besser, wrote a book on the Obeids and how they pursued them through the paper and, you know, initially lost a defamation action even though they knew they were probably on the right track and all these things. And finally, when he's been referred for criminal charges and you know, named as a corrupt person by the ICAC in New South Wales, they wrote this book. Now, they were real careful on all the main stuff on the Obeids, and there was a minor bit about a guy, I can't remember his name, was it John Brown or something like that?
very common name.
Yeah. His relationship to the whole bigger picture was tiny. It was a couple of pages in 300 pages. But they got the wrong guy. In terms of the name was right, but who they said he was wrong.
And does that put everything else?
Well, the book had to be pulped.
Oh.
So what I'm saying is it can be, you know, you see your main thing that you're focusing on is the Obeid and the family because you know they're going to come after you. So you're trying to make everything watertight, but it's that little thing that you don't even think about at the time. And that can happen to, like, someone like Kate, who's one of the, you know, the best people going around in the business. So there's that. That's an example of that fear of that unknown little thing. But it's also very exciting and it's great. Yeah, the next morning, you know, we know, sometimes, you know, the phone will ring at 6 or 6.15 and I know the number. It's the Free AW breakfast show. And they want you to go on at just after the rumour file.
Right.
Which is their highest sort of rating period.
Time.
Yeah. And talk about the story. So for us, although, you know, it's earlier than you like to be woken, although since having kids I'm...
And the cat.
And the dog and all that sort of stuff. It's not as big a drama as it used to be. But that's exciting, you know, because then you can get out and promote your story to a different audience, you know, and say, for example, 3AW, what might be a hell of a lot of... not a lot of age readers might be listening. Some are, some aren't. And then you might...
It's a new audience.
...go on to Neil Mitchell or John Fain or whatever, and it kicks it on throughout the day. And that's really exciting.
Yeah.
And all that apprehension and... you know, expectation of what's coming. How do you, you must have an outlet or several outlets for dealing with that. You mentioned sport in your story. Does that play a big part?
Well, I did want to mention that too, because I think it's interesting the relationship you have with your creative pursuits and your investigative journalism and your sport, because you do have a really strong connection to sport. And I was lucky enough to play football with you for many years, and your tenacity, good nature and leadership qualities on the field were something that I very, very strongly admired. And I think, do you see anything, any transference of these skills from the sporting field to what you do as an investigative journalist?
Very kind of you, Nick.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, in a sense that the what I see transferring, well, one, you need an element of determination or persistence, because, you know, stories aren't easy to crack. And
yeah.
You know, they're not just going to, people aren't just going to fall over just because you ask them a question or send them an email. Hmm. So you've got to be tough in terms of persevering with sort of things and also copping a bit back. But in dealing with people, I think you've got to be able to read people and relate to all sorts of different people. And there's no one way of dealing with a person or getting them to like you, not even necessarily like you, but just trust you a bit or respect you or whatever. So you got to know where to make your pitch to them. What level? How does this person think? What are they? What kind of person are they? And I think that helps you in footy clubs, because you get a huge range of guys from all different backgrounds. And you know, you'll get some guys who, you know, would respond to a rocket from the coach, and then you get other guys, particularly Gen Y types or whatever, who don't like, just will not take being yelled at by a coach and go, I don't have to put up with this, and not accept it. And then if you were, you know, a captain or whatever at the club, they'd come whinging to you about what the coach doesn't. So you've got to be this middle, you've got to be a good manager.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you have a fair amount of responsibility in your sports life too, but
yeah.
But even having said that, is that your outlet? Is that how you deal with
outlets? Yeah, I mean, obviously I wish I could still be playing footy like I used to, but I'm getting a bit past that. But, it's, you know, I still play cricket.
You're 17, right, though?
Yes, that's right. Still
I didn't mean to laugh there, Bakes.
No. and other things. And I guess, you know, having kids and things there, I put a lot of energy into that, and I'm involved with my son's sport and, you know, go and watch my... my daughter's learning music and I play, you know, guitar with her and different things like that. So... and those times I really switch off and don't pick up the phone unless I, you know, really have to, and things can wait. And so I think if you've got to compartmentalise life a bit like that, or you would go crazy, and it wouldn't help you in your work, and it certainly wouldn't help you in your home life. And yeah, sometimes you just need that for yourself. And I'll be honest, the other thing I still need is I need to be let off the leash every 3 or 4 months. I need to go on a bender.
And it's your way to cope.
I just need time for myself with my mates. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to do anything much, but just to be left alone and to go out and just, like, get drunk with my friends. Yeah, release, not answer my phone and not have to get up and do anything the next
morning. Yeah, I imagine you must be pretty tied to your phone through your work.
Yeah.
Like...
oh, it's constant. Yeah, it is. It's a constant thing. And it's a blessing and it's a curse. I mean, it's a blessing because I can be in other places and still... do what I need to do and still be reached, you know, on the train to come and do this. I organised through work for a contact or a source who's in Perth to be flown over for a night, and so we can, you know, pick his brains and different things like
Perth, that seems to be in the mining space. Is that maybe...
No, it's not
don't
mining.
Don't change careers, Nick.
Not mining.
Just being a detective.
Yeah, no, different.
Let's change tact, and I just want to talk really quickly about some of the awards that you've won. along with your partner in crime, Nick McKenzie, you've received the highest honour, really, in Australia for investigative journalism, the Walkley Awards, which recognise creative and courageous acts of journalism. Now, you've won 3 consecutive years in a row. You've also won several Press Club Awards and also a Quill Award for Excellence in Victorian Journalism for your work exposing the misconduct of one of Australia's leading surgeons, which we spoke about. Is this public recognition part of what drives you?
No.
Yeah, just straight no.
No, not at all.
They think about it for a second.
No, it's not why you do the stories at all. I mean, if you're fortunate enough to get, you know, industry recognition or whatever, no one's going to knock that back. It's really helpful, and internally it's you know, it's helpful, and it's something the bosses like to see, and they can sort of hang their hat on a few of those things. And it certainly doesn't harm you, and it helps actually in terms of bringing, you know, other perspective people forward.
Yeah.
Because they see that, you know, oh, well, maybe this is someone who can help me.
Help me.
This story. But honestly, it's not the be all and end all. For me, it's only someone else's opinion of your work. So that's really what it comes down to. So I'm not saying I'm not pretending to be Mother Teresa and saying it's not nice, it's great,
yeah.
It happens, but it's certainly not a motivating factor or even a factor in deciding what stories to do.
To do,
you know.
Okay.
I think sometimes you can see, sometimes in the media, more so in America, it's called award shopping almost, or whenever people see an award and then pick a story that will get them to that kind of thing. And I don't think you should play it like that. You just you deal with what comes along, and you choose it for the right reasons, is because it needs to be exposed. It's going to help people. It needs to be told.
And around that idea of selecting which stories you tell, you know, as actors, we sometimes work on a job where we're responsible for creating the character and developing the story, you know, as part of the creative development and rehearsal for the piece. But often we're working on a published play where the story or the TV episode or whatever has already been written. When you go into an investigative story, though, it's a complete unknown.
Yeah.
You know, you're going off a spark of an idea. How do you deal with that, and how does it help drive you?
Well, you just got to accept that not everything's going to be a winner. You know, you're not ever going to get the answers to some stories.
That's got to be frustrating.
Yeah, it is. It's frustrating, but it's sort of part of the landscape. Sometimes the people you need to cooperate for very good reasons have moved on or don't want to buy back into a deal of trouble, or the risk for them in terms of cooperation with you is just too big, i.e. They could get found out and lose their job. So if they work in government or in the private sector and they've got confidentiality clauses in their employment contracts, or if it's to do with sort of criminal stuff or whatever, the risk of harm to them or their family is just not worth the effort. And so as frustrating that it is to you as a reporter, because you need them for the story to come out, you've got to accept it. It's their life. It's their decision. Then you just say, well, can I do this another way, or am I just going to put this in on the back burner and move on to something else?
And if you end up in a period of time where you feel like everything you're working on is a bit of a false start, how do you stay motivated?
It's kind of like it's like a drug addiction almost, in terms of the it's like golf, I suppose, in that for people who aren't good at golf.
Yes, I'm listening.
People who aren't good at golf hit, maybe they play 18 holes and you hit 2 or 3 good shots.
Yeah.
And that's enough to sustain you, that wow, that was such a good shot, through the misery of 60 or 70 terrible shots. And journalism's a bit like that too. The spike you get from a really good story
is
so good,
sufficient,
that you'll put up with some really big troughs to try and find that next big one.
You know what? I get the golf analogy. I get that for acting too, because, you know, it's the same deal. You know, you've got to take success when, or the feeling when it comes, because, you know, it's not always going to be there, and it can't be always there, and it can't be the thing that drives you the whole way along. You have to, you're almost chasing feeling.
If we start comparing my acting career to golf, maybe a few things are becoming clear.
I do love that that's a connection of your story between your creative side and your love of sport, Bakes, which is great. just a change of tone now. As far as storytellers, do you have a favourite storyteller in any medium?
No, not a nominated sort of favourite at all. Mm. I mean, I like when I have my downtime and different things like that, I like reading Vanity Fair or New Yorker and those things, because those journalists working or those writers have the luxury of having a lot of time to really, you know, layer their stories, and they're so well edited and researched and told. It's enjoyable to read, and they can hook you in pretty quickly, and you can still learn a lot from it too. So for me, it's something that you'd really like to bring into your own journalism, albeit being realistic that, you know, I'm not going to be able to be paid to do one or two stories a year, which is what some of those people, because the American market's that big, is fortunate enough to do that. So I love that, and there's no one particular person there. And then, you know, when I'm on holidays, I just like a good page turner, you know, an Ian Rankin or something like that.
Yeah.
Just that I don't, again, don't have to think too much about. So don't have a favourite storyteller. And then if we look, you know, what everyone's doing now is, you know, streaming through Netflix or other things, or DVD series like your Breaking Bad, your House of Cards, the Scandinavian ones like Bridge or The Killing, stuff like that. I'm really enjoying that kind of storytelling as well. On the ABC Sunday night, second series of Broadchurch, one I enjoyed the first series of that, and I recorded it and watched it last night, the start of the second series. Again, it was just, they're just so well done. They fitted so much refreshing of what happened, you know, in series one to take you back into where it's at. Then injecting within 45 minutes of a program, you know, setting up the whole new series with all these things.
It's an art.
It's a real art, and I admire that. And I think it's great to learn from, well, like Serial in the radio or the podcasting sphere, those kind of DVD series and things, and the Vanity Fair stuff. There are some differences, but also some commonalities in the storytelling there. And sometimes it's about what to leave out, not what to put in.
Yeah, and it is about consuming that content to then influence your own creative pursuits, isn't it? So that's the beauty of taking things in like that. And it might not be the same medium, but at least you're taking it in, and in some way it's going into you and then possibly coming out in your work as well. So
pace and momentum that they all have there.
Yeah. So do you... On that note, do you have any advice for the budding journalists and non-fiction writers of the world who might already feel they have a particular story they want to tell, or just want to get into storytelling?
Your basic advice is just don't put any restrictions on yourself, in terms of don't think that, oh, because I'm a nobody or I'm a young student or whatever, that this person isn't going to talk to me, or I have no right to ask a question of the CEO of ANZ Bank or whatever. Well, you have as much right as anybody else.
Mm.
You might find that doors are slammed in your face, so to speak, but persevere, you know, have the gumption to challenge yourself and not place any limits on your reporting, and just learn by doing, you know? And that's the best way to get into it. And that it's a really difficult environment, because the traditional ways of getting a job and employment in the media is shrinking, yet because of technology and different things, there's so many other opportunities opening up, and it's up to people you've got to make your own way.
So this is the final question, Bakes, that we ask everyone, and I've tweaked it obviously for the investigative journalism sphere. So if your life were a breaking news story, what would the headline be?
Man seeks people with information between the hours of Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, leave a message.
Excellent.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Rich. Well, that was an amazing interview.
Oh, we've been chasing an investigative journalist for so long, or a journalist full stop, and it was so lovely to get someone. It's another angle.
So many things he said about scrutinising sources and following leads and false starts, I was surprised at how much of a parallel there seems to be with the work that we do to tell stories, which I guess it shouldn't be a surprise to me at all.
No, you mean the rigour in which he investigates the story?
The rigour with which he investigates the story, how it's important to find the narrative, a million things that he said that in a different way correlate to the work that we do.
Yeah, and I found that really interesting too, and I think I mentioned it in the actual interview, was this idea of how you consume information from other mediums and how it portrays into your work as well. So, you know, how he watched shows like Breaking Bad and how he loved and Broadchurch, I think, was the one that he described, and how it flowed into how he worked.
And how he learns from that.
Correct, and how he learns from that. I think it's really beautiful, that, as well.
Yeah, there was something he said, it was early on in the interview, about when he was starting out on a story and how stories start. And it was just a quick thing he said, but that it was about the human contact. Mm. And I don't know, I guess that my favourite word really resonated with me, because so much of the stuff we're doing at the moment, the creative development we're doing for one of the short films,
yes,
a lot of the training, this keeps coming back to me. It's all about the human contact.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting when you're looking at a guy whose work comes across so many other platforms at the moment, but where does it originate? Oh, I don't know. It's really got me thinking.
Oh, just one more takeout that I want to talk about too was this idea of new mediums in that space. I really love the idea of, you know, how journalists can tell stories differently and also affect a market in a new way, because I think Serial does that so fantastically. And I'm sure that, and you could tell by the way that Richard approached the questions, that The Age are thinking the exact same thing. And how do we engage the readers in new ways is super exciting.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. You know, he brought up that thing about the Washington Post and how they did something like that in years previously, but also that it's the size of the market over there and how we'd love to be someone who writes one or two stories a year for Vanity. Again, it parallels with the challenges we face here with the size of our market. Oh, it's so interesting. Another great podcast in the bag.
Podcast 12. Now we look forward to the month ahead. How's your month looking, Lauren?
Well, that's an interesting question, Nick. As we know, I've got day of shooting coming up in the next month.
Yes.
But I'm not 100% clear on how the rest of the month looks. I was really hoping to be able to participate in the Larry Moss Masterclass that's coming up at 16th Street.
Yep.
But unfortunately, I missed out on that opportunity. So there is a chance that instead I might be going to Singapore.
Singapore?
As you do.
As you do.
To shadow Ali T. Miller, who I've trained with in Bali.
Yes, yes, yes. And spoken about on this podcast.
Yes, the wonderful, wonderful Ali, who is currently, obviously he teaches at LaSalle, but he's also directing a show that opens in late April, I think. And I might get to see the LaSalle grad production while I'm there. So,
how lovely is your life? You know what? I'm going to go to Singapore and just do an internship with Ale.
I think it's a pretty unique opportunity.
It is. It's a great opportunity.
I'm quite excited about that.
When do you find out whether you're going to do that?
Well, I just need to get my shoot dates confirmed before I book tickets, because I don't want to overlap that.
Yep.
Yeah, and other than that, I'm hopefully working on starting to put a voice reel together this month.
Fantastic. How great.
Starting.
A voice reel.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, obviously, you know, I have lots of recorded material from this podcast and a few other small things I've done, but I just want to do a bit of investigation on my voice brand. You know, I think a lot about my acting brand, but I haven't really thought in that sense before.
Yeah, a lot of actors use it as a more constant source of income too, because the idea is that you can be in and out within an hour and, you know, do shorter, sharper jobs, I guess, and you can do more of them in the
Absolutely. It is something that I've thought of in the past, but when I've been working full time and trying to do as much as possible for my acting career, it hasn't been something that I've had to say no.
And it does
I haven't
take time.
Had the resources. And also to be available to do the work. I feel like that's something that I could definitely do more of in my life now. And I believe in the last recording of of podcast 12 that we haven't been able to go live with. I put something out to the universe about just letting anyone in the Australian television industry know that I'm fully prepared and ready to act in your television shows.
Beautiful paid segment.
I'm free later this month.
Get in touch.
What about you, Nick? You've obviously got some more shooting commitments coming up.
Yeah.
And some other stuff.
Some shooting commitments with Neighbours, which is great. So making the journey back and forth from Sydney during that time. So that'll be the next couple of months, actually.
And how is it going? How are you finding your feet in the acting world in Sydney?
It's slow going. I think it's worth noting at this point that whilst I am in Sydney, I think I've spent a total of about 6 days there. Look, there's been plenty of people that have actually touched base, which I really appreciate, to even just have a coffee and chat about the industry. So, look, as soon as I get a moment in my calendar, I totally am planning to catch up with them. But I am looking forward to it because it's a whole new market. It's a whole new market.
Well, yeah, I'm really excited to hear just over the next few months how that goes.
And hopefully with that too, I can open up some thoughts for people that aren't in the Sydney industry as well. So people, if you're based in Melbourne, if you're based in Brisbane or Adelaide, you might just, or even Perth, don't want to forget about you, or Tassie, just open up what the Sydney industry is like. And then hopefully, if you're listening in Sydney, there's some insights that you can take out too. So this is kind of the beauty of both you being in Melbourne, Lauren, and myself being in Sydney.
Yeah, definitely.
Covering two big locations in the Australian industry.
And of course, we're going to take a month off from the podcast. We need to talk about when we go live with podcast 13 and the shape of the year ahead for us. But yes, we're definitely hoping to speak to some interstate storytellers to continue to investigate what the industries are like across the country and how storytelling differs.
And also hopefully, Lauren, I don't want to give too much away, but also inputting into what is the Active Storytelling brand as well.
So have you got a recommendation for the month ahead, Nick?
I do. And you know that I love my festivals. And it is that time of year for festivals. Now, there is one that I want you to go check out if you're on the Eastern Seaboard. I don't even care if you're in Melbourne. You need to fly up to Sydney and check this out. It is called the Spectrum Now Fest. Spectrumnow.com.au. It's from the 11th to the 29th of March. So it's already happening right now. Richard Roxburgh is the creative director of it.
Oh, wow.
Which is fantastic. And the name's fitting because the idea of the festival is that it covers many, many different artistic pursuits, whether it be all the way over in the opera circles, all the way through to gardening creativity. Now, the beauty of this festival is that Richard Roxburgh has been there from the start. He's helped to curate it. And also, it's actually got great funding from ANZ and The Age. And there is actually a central focus as well called the Spectrum Playground. Much like if you've been to the Fringe Festival, the Fringe Hub, or in Adelaide, the Garden of Unearthly Delights, Richard Roxburgh promises plenty of surprises. So I think if you go along to the event, you could be surprised at what you actually see.
Ooh.
So a beautiful little event. And you know I love festivals. And this is an exciting little one that hopefully, because it has the backing and the broad range of creativity, that it could possibly become quite a beautiful festival in the future too, like something much like, I guess, what has happened with White Knight. It's just gone kaboom. This is another one that I think, if done correctly, could be the same. Have you got a recommendation for us, Laura?
Yes, I do. I have been doing a little bit of script writing over the last couple of months, and I just wanted to mention a great resource that we became aware of late last year called The Script Colony. Now, it's primarily intended as a resource for screenwriters, and it lists networks who are accepting submissions. It has links to podcasts and interviews. You can read full screenplays. So I read Gone Girl.
Great.
Some of the other Oscar screenplays are up there, I noticed. Wow. I want to check out Birdman.
Oh, yeah, that'd be a good read, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just really interesting, having obviously seen the film, which is amazing, and then going, oh, well, you know,
Where did that come from?
Yeah. Even if you're not a writer, it has links to everything that's in production in film and TV nationally here, which Screen Australia does also, but also in the US, links to The Hollywood Reporter, what's happening for pilot season. I just think it's a bit of a great hub.
Great,
so I'll put a link up to that, and I definitely recommend anyone who's interested check it out.
Fantastic.
So just to wrap up our first year of podcasting, we've got to figure out what is coming next for the Active Storytelling.
Yes.
And we're not sure how long that will take.
Yes.
We might be live April 10th, but it might be May 10th.
Yeah.
Yes. Bear with us. Keep an eye on the website. You can also check out on Facebook what we're up to. We post on there a lot. And if you have anything to post for us, any storytelling goodness, please do so.
I think that's the thing to remember is certainly social media will be very active on. So feel free to check it out, check out the page regularly, and also send us stuff, as you said, Lauren. And hopefully that'll keep the juggernaut that is the active storytelling community live.
Yep, we're a juggernaut.
Omnipotent.
We're an omnipotent juggernaut.
So continue to join us on the active storytelling.
And thanks for listening.